WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Nicole Panter has described herself as a bad girl and feminist. Her resume is an unlikely combination of sex, politics, literature, and rock and roll. In the late 70s, she managed the notorious L.A. punk band The Germs. She was a founding member and writer of Pee-wee's Playhouse. She worked at a hospice for the dying in Calcutta, and for a while made a living in the States, working as a topless dancer and doing phone sex. All of these occupations and preoccupations are evident in her new book, Mr. Right On, and Other Stories. We invited her for an interview and reading. The reading is an excerpt of the story Mr. Right On, which details the adventures of an idealistic but somewhat naive feminist activist who's picked up at a conference by a fellow panelist. He's an older, well-known academic liberal. He seduces her during dinner.
"You're so lucky to be a woman," he said to her, his eyes glistening as he spoke. "Women are born with a natural compassion that men can never really hope to have." His head dropped to his chest and he sighed. "My wife left me 8 months ago. We're separated and she's not coming back. She's a lot younger than I am. She's your age. We were both very unhappy. We fought constantly. She can't handle the attention I've been getting since the book. It's for the best. I don't have many friends. I guess I'm pretty lonely." She didn't know what to say to him, so she said nothing. He got up, walked across the room, and put some money in the jukebox. A song came on. She recognized it immediately. "Percy Mayfield, Please Send Me Someone to Love." He came back to the table and extended his hand to her. "Will you dance with me?" She hesitated a minute and then slipped off her high heels, discreetly, she hoped, under the table. On the dance floor, he held her close, one hand at the small of her back. They swayed to the music, and he looked at her deeply, meaningfully. She thought she could feel him bump against her thigh. She waited for him to speak. "You know," he said, "I have black relatives." "Oh, brother," she thought to herself. "Maybe I'm just not hearing this right."
Oh, that's great. That's Nicole Panter reading the title, an excerpt of the title story of her collection, Mr. Right On. He has the greatest pickup line, I have to say. "I'd love to talk politics with you."
There's a lot of those guys out there.
Have you met people who've tried to pick you up with a line like that?
And been successful.
No, why would that?
Sadly enough.
Why would that work on you?
Well, not recently, but years back. You know, you're young and naive and you think they want to get to know you for your brains.
If you don't mind my skipping ahead and giving away some of the ending here, I'll say that he does successfully pick her up, and they have days and nights of passionate lovemaking. And then he goes back to his wife and leaves her with a monster bladder infection. And I thought, not very often that you'll find that at the end of a short story about passionate lovemaking.
Well, I guess in real life you might, though.
Exactly. Oh, I was interested in your choice of putting that in.
I taking this sort of glaze off the romance, you know, the mist off the romance, the things I like to write about are things that could happen in real life. And a bladder infection is just as likely as three kids in a house with a picket fence.
Nicole, there's something that I find really interesting and paradoxical about your work. On the one hand, you're really involved in a lot of political activities. I'm just going to list some of the groups that you've been involved with. You co-founded the Bohemian Women's Political Alliance. You've been with the Coalition for Reproductive Rights, the Wednesday Morning Coalition for Peace and Justice in El Salvador, ACT UP, the Homeless Writers Coalition, the Women's Action Coalition, the Haitian Refugee Center. You also write a lot of, you might call it erotica or pornography, whichever. You've been, I think, a stripper. You've done phone sex. So you're this just amazing mix of political and politically incorrect.
I guess so. I think First of all, you have to have a sense of humor about everything, life included, injustice included. Otherwise, it becomes unbearably sad. And I think when I was really little, I decided that I wanted to have adventures and be an adventuress. And I guess I'm kind of succeeding in that. I do believe that sex work is something that is tremendously empowering to women if they are the ones who benefit from it financially. I certainly wouldn't have been able to do the creative things I'd done unless I danced.
You were very involved in the Los Angeles punk scene in the 1970s. You even managed one of the bands, The Germs. Do you see your writing connecting to the punk music of that period?
Yeah, I see it very much like the dynamic of punk back then, the thing that was so exciting about it. And I have to say that it was, for all its hard edge weirdness, it was fun and funny and one of the best times I've ever had in my life. The do-it-yourself dynamic, if people didn't know necessarily how to play an instrument, that didn't stop them from picking it up and learning how to play it while on stage over a period of months or years. If a record company was not interested in a band, that didn't stop a band from putting out its own record and distributing it itself. And I've kind of taken, there's a whole bunch of us writers who kind of took from that ethos and went ahead and wrote whether or not anyone wanted to put it out for us. And I put little books out myself for a few years. As soon as I had enough material for a book, 100 pages or so, I'd go down to the Xerox machine or whatever corporation I was working at the time. We'd go into the Xerox room and do myself some midnight Xeroxing and go home and staple the books together and go around to bookstores and sell them.
My guest is Nicole Panter. Her new collection of short stories is called Mr. Right On and Other Stories. Back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nicole Panter. You have a piece about punk rock in your new collection, Mr. Right On, that has to do with the emotional connection you felt you made to punk rock and to the other people involved with the music. I want you to read a short excerpt of that.
Okay. There's no need to explain the way this music, this noise, makes you feel. There's no need to explain why, when you get dressed every day, you do everything you can to make yourself look as ugly on the outside as you feel on the inside. There's no need to explain your hurt or your anger or the damage you feel, because it is perfectly self-explanatory in this place, in this music.
Did you feel when you discovered punk music that you were finding this community of people that you didn't know existed?
Well, there were five of us in L.A. When I first realized I was a punk. There were probably about four or five, maybe 20 other people. Yeah, and we were like the leper colony. It was a lot of really overly bright kids from overly dysfunctional families.
Would you describe the band that you eventually managed, The Germs?
Well, they weren't exactly a musical experience. It was more of... they became, and are, I mean, their record has never gone out of print. It's still available at any record store, at Tower Records or anywhere like that. It was anarchy on stage. It was like watching something fall apart, and in pretty short order. I mean, it would take maybe 10 minutes for the set to fall apart, and after that, anything went. And it was kind of exciting and adrenaline-inducing. And it was also, you know, for me as, like, you know, an 18-year-old band manager trying to take my job seriously, really frustrating. I would just stand at the side of the stage and cry, oh, why can't they do a whole set? Which is not to say that it all went by me, because, I mean, I kind of got what was going on. But in a way, the legend of The Germs... wears a lot better than the reality would have.
What was it like for you as a woman in that world?
Well, actually, women, and a lot of other women I know from back then will agree, the scene was populated with powerful women and actually sort of weaker guys. There was a lot of strength amongst the women, amongst the girls. We kind of called the shots.
You know, in your piece about punk and Mr. Right On, you write about making yourself as ugly on the outside as you feel on the inside. Is that the way you saw the fashion statement, so to speak, of punk?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. A lot of us came from all of us came from pretty dysfunctional homes. And a lot of us went through adolescence being outcast, you know. I definitely wasn't the prom queen where I grew up. And I think the attitude was, well, okay, I'm going to shove this back at you. This is what you made me, and now you're going to have to look at it. At least that was my feeling.
You've talked about how you felt you and a lot of the other people in punk music were smart people from really dysfunctional families. What was your family like?
Really weird. Eccentric. My dad was this guy named Pat Oliveri, and he basically invented the Philadelphia cheesesteak sandwich and made a lot of money from it, moved his family to the desert in California, and he owned a world champion light heavyweight boxer when I was growing up. And so my parents were always going off to boxing matches. My mother was always dressed in sables and diamonds and all of that. And there was a lot of that. It was kind of a violent household. My mother was about 30 years younger than my father. And while it seemed glamorous and somewhat eccentric from the outside, it was pretty rough on the inside. And I guess I was an iconoclast from the minute I popped out of the womb, because I was always getting in trouble and, you know, always running away. And I finally did run away when I was 14 and didn't go back.
But here you were always getting in trouble, and yet it wasn't like you were from a family that was of the straight-laced middle-class variety. I mean, your father sounds like he had one foot in the underworld anyways.
Well, yeah, but he was always threatening me with convent school. He would always say, do as I say, not as I do. And my mother was like his fifth wife or something like that. And it was kind of hypocritical and weird. And a lot of people were afraid of my dad because he was a frightening figure. It was strange. We were basically raised by a lot of really nice, sympathetic, hired people.
A servant?
Who tried to protect us from my father's temper as much as they could. But after a certain point, you know, I was always really strong-willed, and so I just left.
Did you have any sense of where you were going?
Yeah, I went further into the Coachella Valley, and I actually worked in the fields for a little while because I knew they would look for me in Hollywood.
Did you leave a note behind?
No, I didn't want to go back.
Did they find you?
No. A few years later, I'd heard that my father died, and I went back to visit. And it was still really strange. I don't get along with my family.
Do you speak with them?
No.
So when did you start building a viable life for yourself? I mean, you were really young to be on your own.
Yeah, but I sort of learned survival skills early.
Doing what?
Dodging my father. You know, dodging flying objects.
Oh, I see. You mean
learning
in the house.
Places.
Back
yeah,
in your
yeah.
home.
Yeah.
So, but where did you stay as a 14-year-old on your own?
Well, at the time, and it was the early 70s, there were, like, hippies and people in vans and, you know, and you just figure out what the coin of the realm is, and you either deal with it or disappear.
So you were a street kid for a while?
For a little while, yeah. Yeah, but because of a lot of things, I was always able, I didn't have a problem working really hard, and I was really sort of canny about what I had to do to survive and still be within my limits of morality and decency.
No, it seems like most of your life you've been like on the artistic fringes.
Yeah.
I don't mean on the fringes of artistry, but among the circle of artists who are always on the fringes, because what they're doing is considered too radical or subversive or underground or whatever. When did you realize that that's what you were going to gravitate to, whether it was music or writing?
When I was about 3, probably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I, you know, maybe a little older than that, but not much. I was always artistic and an outcast, but, you know, also part of, you know, one of the contrary answers to that is some of the people that were part of that have gone on to make enormous, enormous sums of money. Matt Groening, who went on to do The Simpsons, you know, practically lived on my couch for 3 years. He was my husband's best friend. And no one thought that he was ever going to amount to anything.
Does that make you wish that you had found something that was really commercial?
No, I'm happy. I'm, you know, believe it or not, I'm happy. I'm artistically fulfilled. I lead an exciting, fun, interesting life. I don't know that money has solved the problems that a lot of people I knew were having who've made money.
Nicole Panter, her new book, Mr. Right On and Other Stories, is published by Incommunicado Press. This is Fresh Air.